Number one of an interview with Dr. Clinton Ann Woolsey, Professor Emeritus of Neurophysiology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Woolsey was born on November 30, 1904, in Brooklyn, New York, and was trained at Union College in Schenectady, New York, and at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. He did his early research in cerebral localization in Baltimore, where he was a member of the Department of Physiology from 1933 to 1948, when he moved to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He was Schlichter Professor of Neurophysiology from 1948 until 1975, when he became Professor Emeritus. Dr. Woolsey was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 1960 and served as director of the Laboratory of Neurophysiology at the University of Wisconsin from 1960 until 1973. He has been active in numerous international organizations devoted to research in the neurosciences. This interview was conducted on February 12, 1982, in Dr. Woolsey's office in the Weissman Center on the University of Wisconsin campus. The interviewer was Calvin Pierce, representing the University of Wisconsin Medical Alumni Association.
So you wanted me to say how I got involved with science.
Yeah. Well, we didn't how did you get started in?
Well, I date it back to the end of my third year in high school. I had gone to school in the public schools of New York. First 2 years I spent in high school in Montgomery, New York, and then I moved to a place up in near Oneonta, New York, which is near the Otsego Lake, and there I spent my third year. Now, because of moving from school to school and having various kinds of teachers, not all subjects were equally easily pursued. Nevertheless, I found that in this town of Skenevis, I was the outstanding scholar that year, although it was my poorest year in all of high school. But I had higher grades than anybody else, and they had an award they called the Bernard Medal. It actually is about the size of a silver dollar, and it's made of complete gold.
Really?
I don't know what it's worth now, but it was gold. And not gold-plated, but solid gold. And I received that. And I had not expected to go to this meeting, but the principal said that he wanted a promise from me that I would be there. He didn't tell me why he wanted me to be there, but he said there was a reason and he wanted me to be there. So that's what was the reason. That was the reason. It happened that that day an individual who had, as a boy, spent some of his summers in that vicinity, he had lived in Albany, New York, had arrived on a trip, driving his car, and in those days cars were likely to break down, and so you dressed up in overalls and didn't necessarily shave that day. And when he arrived just before the youngsters of the family they were visiting were about to go off to the commencement, the boys who were taking the girls said, "Well, we're not going. The doctor's here, and we're not going." And he said, "Well, girls, if you want to go, I'll take you, and the boys can stay home." So then they said they'd go, but he said, "No, you won't. You didn't want to go. You're going to stay home." So he went, and he was present when this award was given. He asked about this fellow who'd received it, and they said, "Well, he'd only been there a year, but he lives up on the hill, on a farm up on the hill." And they told him what they knew about me, but they didn't know too much. So he went to see the principal the next day.
What was the man's name again?
Dr. Walter Allen Cowell.
Cowell
was his name.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went to see the principal the next day to find out what he could about me. And it turned out that the principal was about to go to the same city in western New York for a new job, which where the doctor lived, which was Olean, New York. And he apparently spoke well of me, and so the doctor then said, well, why don't you, I don't have the time because we are due in Albany, he said, to go up and visit him, but why don't you go and find out whether he'd be willing to come to Olean and continue his education there. So he did, and I went to Olean.
Was Olean a public school, private
school? It's a public school. It's a, it was the best of the high schools that I attended in New York State, and we did quite well there. And so I got to know Dr. Cowell then, and he turned out to be a very stimulating person. He had, as I mentioned the other day, while he was a general practitioner, he was very much interested in the new work that was going on, and the insulin had just been discovered, and he was the first person in that city to use it on any patient, and he was writing his results with it. And so he stimulated the notion that the doctor ought to be involved with investigative work as well as in practice. So I got that notion from him. Then I went to the school that he had gone to, which was the Union College in Schenectady, New York, and where I entered in the fall of 24, I guess it was. Yeah, 1924. And there he had gone to school there, and had after graduating as an undergraduate degree, he went to their medical school, which was Albany Medical College. And I was stimulated by him to think of the possibility of finishing at Union and also going to the Albany Medical College. He had been a scholar, very much interested in Latin and Greek, and he told me he thought that was a good thing to keep up, and I did do that in college, or at least the first 2 years. And then in college, I found another influence, and that was that there was a marvelous professor of psychology. He had not been trained as a psychologist, but when psychology was a subject they began introducing into college curriculum, the college explored whether any people on the faculty who might have an interest in the subject. And he had been studying the behavior of birds and other wild creatures, so what we'd call ethology today, and he said he would be willing to try to offer such a course, and of course he'd been doing that for a number of years because he was near the end of his career when I had him, but he was a perfectly wonderful teacher and could vividly present the results of experiments so vividly that you almost felt you were right in the presence of the experimenter and the animal that he was studying. And he could portray the work of Sherrington or of Pavlov in such a vivid manner that it was really striking.
What was his name again?
His name was Johnny Marsh, M-A-R-S-H. They never called him John. His name was John, but he was always known as Johnny Marsh. He was the brother of Peyton C. Marsh, who's the head of our military organization during the First World War. For a time I thought, well, that's the area to go into this field of behavioral psychology, and thought for a time of going to take a PhD degree at Columbia University, where another man that he liked to describe the experiments of was the professor. But I'd already intended, my thoughts were already settled on medicine, and that was a diversion from the original goal for a few months at least.
Were you a major in biology then?
My first 2 years were majored primarily in the classics, Latin and Greek, and history and things of that sort. And I put off taking all the courses, except for biology, I took put off taking the courses that were required for entrance to medical school until my junior year in college. I think maybe I had physics the second year, and math, but I didn't have any biology, any chemistry in the first 2 years at all. But we did finish taking all the required courses for entrance to medical school. And in those days, to enter Hopkins, you had, which is the one I was planning to, hoped I could get into, you had to have some Latin. I think it required 2 years of Latin. They also required a reading knowledge of French and German. So I had both French, and I'd had French in high school, but German in college. I planned to take German in high school, but the very year that I was to take it, the war broke out. 1917, got into the war, and for some curious reason, the state of New York decided that no German would be taught in any of the schools. Seems rather unusual point of view.
How did you decide that you were interested in going to Hopkins? Why Hopkins?
Well, partly because some of my people that I knew at college had gone down there, and they came back and told me what a wonderful curriculum they thought they had, and so that's probably the reason. One fellow in particular had gone down a year before, and when he came back and told me about it, I was really quite pleased with it. Actually, I applied there, and then I noticed that since I would have to have some scholarship help, I noticed that Harvard had a lot more to offer in way of scholarship. So I was on the point of applying to Harvard when I was asked by Hopkins to go to New York to be interviewed. And very quickly after the interview, I got a message from Baltimore that I had been accepted. So I quit looking anywhere else. So the thing had been settled. So I arrived in Baltimore in the fall of 28, after graduating from the Union, and among the things I remember that happened early there that are related to the direction in which I thought I was going was, I suppose sometime in late October, maybe early November, the neuroanatomist, who was Marion Hines, she's still alive, I believe, but must be in her 90s, she had the habit of going around and getting acquainted with the students, and she came up to me one day and she said, "Well, Mr. Woolsey, why did you come to Hopkins?" See, in those days, students were always addressed as Mr. or Miss. And I said, "I want to be a brain surgeon." She says, "A brain surgeon? Don't you know that's a difficult field?" And she went on. And then later in February, when the course in neuroanatomy was beginning and she was teaching that, she came back and she said, "Are you still thinking of neurosurgery?" And I think that's the first I heard that word. And I said, "Oh, yes." And she said, "Well," she said, "I don't think you ought to think for 4 years that you're going to be a neurosurgeon without trying to find out whether you have any of the skills a neurosurgeon must have. They have to be expert with their hands in all sorts of ways," and said, "I suggest you go see Dr. Sarah Tower, who is in the department, and she's doing some work, and she may be able to use you and teach you these techniques and let you find out whether you've got the skills to do them if you try them." So I went to see Sarah Tower immediately, and she said yes. And I think I stayed awake all that night.
Oh, really?
Never went to sleep with a wink all night. I was so excited. And so following that and working with her for the rest of the year, then Dr. Hines gave a course on cortical localization, which was a subject that she was interested in. And she took six of us students into that course, and there were three instructors. So each two of us had one instructor for each experiment. Mm. There I had six experiments, I think. And then we had to put together a report on some aspect of the work and give a paper at a dinner meeting that she held in her home. And so we got a little more involved, and she then offered me the opportunity, Marion Hines did, to work with her in her lab on some project that we would figure out for the following year. And in the meantime, recommended me for a scholarship, a fellowship, which was called the Denison. The Denison, the people make, they made paper or something of that sort in Denver, Colorado. They had had a son who'd been a student at Hopkins, and he died while he was just after, either while he was a student or after graduating. And they set up this Denison Fellowship, and that was offered to students one at a time, one each year, and I was the one who was successful in getting it for that second year. And I had it for the rest of my time in medical school. Well, the main reason, of course, for at that time for being interested in doing this research on the brain, we worked on dog brain, was the notion I had of becoming a neurosurgeon. And then when I finished, my last year, I had to take out about 6 months of time because of the development of minimal pulmonary tuberculosis. So I didn't graduate with my class of 32, but with the following year's class of 33. And when I had applied for the internship in surgery, but the professor of surgery said, "You have just been out with a pulmonary lesion. I think you shouldn't come on the service immediately, but wait until next year. And in the meantime, go work in the laboratory." Hmm. He meant the surgical laboratory, where they were working on the gut, primarily.
He was worried about your infection.
Yes, he was worried that I might reactivate, if I worked as hard as the interns have to, day and night almost, that I might break down again and have to go back to that would be not so good as taking it easier and making sure I was getting along all right. So he offered me a fellowship in surgery, which I accepted. But then the new professor of physiology had just come from Harvard, where he had worked a lot on the brain of mainly the cat. And the project I had worked on with Marion Hines, some sort of ran together in some of the aspects of it with the work that he had done.
This was
Dr. Philip Bard.
Phil Bard, yeah.
Phil Bard.
Yeah.
And when he met me and began to talk about that, he said, if you're going to work in the laboratory, he said, and want to be a neurosurgeon, why don't you come work with me? You'll learn something about the nervous system. You won't learn much about the nervous system working on the gut. And he said, I'll even give you a little higher stipend than the surgical fellowship will.
Offer you couldn't refuse.
It was worth $100 a month. That's what fellowships were in those days. And the dean said to him, "What did you offer him so much for?" He said, "You could have had him for $1,000. which he could have, of course. So I began working with him, and we continued working for 4 years. And then all of a sudden, all this while, I was still thinking I was going to go on with neurosurgery. But finally, I realized that I wasn't. I was going to stay in physiology, so that's how we got into physiology.
You've been working, though, with him then for a while on neurosurgical experiments.
Well, in those days, the main type of experiment which was done in the physiology laboratories was to make lesions, that is, remove parts of the brain and see what the effects thereof were on the animal's behavior or its neurological status.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the first studies we did with him were similar to what I'd done on the dog, which was to study the effects of removing the motor areas and sensory areas, and then to see how these affected certain reactions, which are called placing reactions and hopping reactions. You may never have tested a dog or a cat, but you pick up a cat, blindfold it, and bring it forward like this, touch its feet, it'll do this.
Set its paws.
Set its paws down. Or if you stand it up on one leg and displace it this way, it jumps like that, it hops. That's what we call hopping. In the case of a monkey, which is the animal we began to study, it turned out these reactions were much more refined than they were in cats and dogs. Monkey, instead of doing this, he may do this, or he may just do that. Grasp it.
Choice his, of grabbing or...
And he can do that with his hand or with his foot. So that we began to use these to study a problem which had been difficult to study in animals, which was to try to find, to discover the precise limits of the arm and the leg areas, the face areas, in the sensory and motor cortex. And so that was what we began working with him.
What was Bard's position then?
He was head of the department.
He was
chairman.
Was by then.
He was, in those days there was only one professor in the department at Hopkins. He was the professor. So he was called the professor.
And he built up quite a reputation.
He had. He was probably in his. He was probably about 34 when he came as chairman. And Hopkins always had the tendency to pick people while they were still young and not wait until they were 40s or 50s. I don't think anybody ever got a job there who was in his 50s. Not as a departmental chairman, certainly.
So were you doing brain surgery then when these lesion experiments were going on? That was what you were helping do?
Actually, I had probably more experience having worked in the on the dog in certain ways, and we had developed a technique which he hadn't seen, which made it possible to make the lesions much more precise. It used to be that you'd take an instrument, something like this, for example, and you would scoop out the brain with a or something more like, I don't have one here, but at any rate, it's a, what we used to call a tonsil dissector.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a blunt end, and it was about 3 millimeters, 2.5 to 3 millimeters wide, and you'd make a little incision in a bloodless area of the cortex and then scoop the cortex out with this device. And that meant that it didn't cut the blood vessels, and you could get the tissue out without causing very much hemorrhage. On the other hand, since you were pressing against the cortex which remained as you scooped, you might damage that from pressure, you see. So a technique which we had started to use, had been used by neurosurgeons for removal of epileptic foci, but they never used it very much in the way we were using it. This was to use a fine pipette with a suction apparatus, and the finer the pipette, the finer the surgery could be. So you could get a pipette with, say, a 0.5 millimeter diameter bore, and you could aspirate out the cortex. And this could be done with without any damage to the cortex that was remaining behind, and you had practically no bleeding either. And so this was, Bard hadn't yet heard of that method when we got to working together, and I began doing many of the operations using that technique in the experiments that we did together.
Was there some awareness then that these ablation methods had reached a limit, maybe, that there needed to be a new techniques introduced?
You mean before the aspiration technique?
Well, I'm thinking soon after this, electrophysiology comes in, and which would refine these by defining the parts of the brain that you're working with. Were people thinking along those lines, that was going to be?
Well, I don't think that was a part of the thought at the moment. The main reason we began using the, I'll tell you how we came to use the thing that led us to use the suction technique for removal of cortex. Dr. Bard had a Belgian come to work with him, and one of the areas that Bard was interested in was the control by the nervous system of sex behavior in the cat. And he assumed, of course, as many would have, that the pituitary had something to do with this. So he decided with this fellow to study the effect of removing the pituitary on the sex behavior of the cat, the female cat. And the problem was how to get this pituitary out. And since I'd been interested in doing something in that general vicinity, I volunteered to see whether I could get this pituitary out by going through the neck below, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it proved to be not too easy with the instruments that we had, and because you drill a hole over the base of the pituitary and then try to scoop it out with a little tiny spoon, and the spoon didn't quite fit around the edges, and you couldn't maneuver it because you were looking into in a distance maybe 2 or 3 centimeters deep, and it was only maybe 1 centimeter wide. And so this suggested the idea, if you really had a suction, you could reach in there and suck it all out, you see. And so that's how the thing began. As soon as we found that worked so nicely, we decided we'd use it on the brain itself, the cortex itself, and that's how we began to work with it.
And your very first paper came out of one of those dog studies, didn't it?
But we didn't use that technique on the dog. We, my first study was on the dog, and it was published a month after I got out of medical school.
Mm-hmm.
But so we continued to work with Bard on the ablational technique, and we were getting along quite nicely. But when another event happened, a man by the name of Wade Hampton Marshall, had received his training in physiology with Ralph Girard at the University of Chicago in the early days of the evoked potential technique. See, the evoked potential was supposed, I think it was 1929 that Berger first described the cortical, the recordings of the evoked potential, or of potentials from the cortex. Not necessarily evoked, but Berger was his name.
Oh, yeah.
Hans Berger.
Yeah, Hans Berger, he was in Switzerland, wasn't he?
No, I thought it was in Austria, but maybe, I'm not quite sure about that. But he, of course, was interested in recording the natural way in which these brain waves were, he called them brain waves, which were being produced. And it was not at that time involved in trying to modify them by any stimulation. But soon it did prove possible to modify them by stimulation. And the problem that was set in Chicago by Girard was to study the whole brain of the cat systematically, going through it point by point with electrodes that could be inserted into the brain, and recording the electrical activity at from different structures to see if we could find out what the recordings from the scalp were due to and what their origins were. Wade and another fellow by the name of his last name was Saul, Wade Marshall and Saul or rather Marshall, Gerard Marshall and Saul was the title of the authorship of that paper. They had done this job on the cat, but I think Wade was very much bored by it because it didn't really come out to anything very, very precise. Mm. They did make some interesting observations, such as, for example, they did record from some results from the cerebellum, which were unexpected. Namely, if you just touch the skin, you get a response. Could get a response, but that the skin wasn't supposed to send any information to the cerebellum in those days.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I'll have to turn over the tape.
Oh yeah.
This is side B of tape number one of an interview with Dr. Clinton N. Woolsey, professor emeritus of neurophysiology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This interview was conducted on February 12, 1982. Okay, so you're talking about Wade Marshall's work.
So he went to work at George Washington University in Washington when he left Chicago. And the man he was working with there was very anxious to see the electrical techniques applied to studying the discharge from the hypothalamus to the pituitary, which was a nice idea, but the methods were certainly not available at that time. But he kept pestering and pushing Wade to do it.
What was his name, do you remember?
I may think of it in a moment, mm-hmm. but... I don't have it in mind at the moment.
Okay.
Anyway, he kept pushing Wade to see if he couldn't record from these fine fibers which come down the pituitary stalk to the pituitary, and Wade was quite right in saying that it's just impossible, it's not possible to do it. But he kept after him, and so Wade finally came over to see Bard to say, find out whether he might come to work in the physiology department. He said he'd be willing to build the equipment for setting up a laboratory of neurophysiology, electrophysiology, if he could get a National Research Council fellowship.
Hmm.
So Bard sponsored him, and he got the fellowship, and he went up to Harvard where Herbert Jasper was the expert on electronics equipment. He's now has a company which is very successful. and Wade built a cathode ray oscilloscope to use the scope tube about so big. He built circuits for it, control circuits, stimulating circuits and everything for about $700.
Hmm.
And brought it back to Baltimore and set up a lab. Well, there had not been any intention, as far as I'm aware, of anyone else becoming involved with this technique, except Marshall would go ahead and do what he wanted to do. When we saw what he was doing, namely studying the responses of the cortex to touching the skin of the cat, it was a beautiful surface positive response like this, and we saw him doing these things. He was interested in understanding how these responses arose, what was their relation to the cells in the cortex and so on, and he had no particular interest in using them to study the relationship between the parts of the body and the cortex.
Mm-hmm.
But that of course was the sort of interest that Bard and I had. That's why we were doing these ablation experiments, see if we could work out the relationship between the arm and the cortex and the leg and the cortex and so on.
He was more interested in cellular physiology.
He was more interested in cellular physiology.
Mm-hmm.
So both Bard and I asked why couldn't we carry out the kind of experiment of mapping the body surface, and he shook his head. He said he had too much of mapping. He wasn't interested in mapping. So after a short effort on Bard's part, why he ceased to push him, but I was the same age, and so I kept pushing him. And I said, really, we ought to try this. We ought to try it on a monkey. That's much more, that's something we really need to know about. And finally, after some time of debating this, he said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. We'll take one monkey, and if it works, we'll do some more. But if it doesn't work, I don't want to hear another thing about it. So we did the first monkey, and we pretty nearly mapped the whole postcentral gyrus in the first animal. We published that in the paper that was finally published, too. And so Wade was caught, and we were all involved, and he seemed to enjoy it after it got going, but I think he was never quite as enthusiastic or willing to work as long as the rest of us were on a given animal. We often worked as long as, say, 39 hours.
Is that right?
On one animal.
Did you work in shifts?
Sometimes, but sometimes you'd keep going. Not as long as 39, but easily all day long, 24 hours, but easily be done. So that's how and that was the very first mapping experiment of any experiment that had been done of mapping the projection of the body surface to the cortex in detail, the way that came out. And that, of course, that changed my whole career, because we didn't quite cease doing ablational experiments. We did some of those after we came out here to Wisconsin, too, especially during the period when I didn't have any electrical equipment yet. But this, of course, then led in the course of time to looking at other animals' brains in the same way, so that we finally studied the cat, we've studied the dog, we've studied the rabbit, we've studied the rat, we've studied the various monkeys, chimpanzee, and so on. And then, of course, you had the copy of the paper of somewhat similar things we did on humans, so that's pretty elementary compared with what one can do on monkeys and chimpanzees. But that was all done on the somatosensory system. And then, because of the detail with which we could work out the relationship between the skin and the brain, it was quite obvious that the motor maps that had been produced in the past had been not done in anywhere near as much detail. So a thing we started back in Baltimore completed here in Madison was to take a look at the motor cortex of the monkey using stimulations of, say, a millimeter, or not more than 2 millimeters apart, and trying to do the complete picture and see whether we got anything like as detailed a map on the motor side as we were getting on the sensory, and it turned out that we could.
In this case, you're stimulating the brain.
Now we're stimulating the brain electrically and producing movements. You have to be very careful to keep the currents near threshold so that you don't overstimulate the brain. So you start below threshold and come up with the current until it is effective.
With the evoked potential method and the stimulating method, were they developed pretty much together?
No, the stimulating technique, that dates back to Fritz and Hitzig way back in 1870, which was, that was about 70 years before the monkey mapping experiments began in 1936. I think we got them published probably in 1942. And so that was some 70 years. The Fritz and Hitzig experiments were some 70 years before, and other people the method of electrical stimulation of the cortex had continued from that time up to
to the time we were working with the evoked potential method. It was much used in the clinical field to define the motor areas and even, of course, to excite sensory phenomena on cortical stimulation in a conscious patient. So that much of that had been done. Of course, you couldn't use that method of exciting the sensory side in an animal because you wouldn't know what he was feeling. But in a patient, you can. They'll tell you that they feel it in the thumb or in the knee or somewhere, somewhere on the body.
But as certainly as the instruments, there was probably a more refinement of the stimulating instruments.
Well, the instruments that they used in the days of Fritz and Hitzig and Farrier and others, and even on humans up until quite late, about the time we were working on the sensory cortex with evoked potentials, was merely to use the inductorium. You know the inductorium. You probably saw it in the physics class. It's two coils, one of which slides over the other, and if you on it even weaker, you bring it out and you tilt the one coil up at an angle until it's... That technique was the first one used. Or sometimes they used the direct currents, interrupted direct current from a battery, for example. They have a short pulse. But when we came to work on the motor cortex, there were, of course, other devices. One was a 60-cycle alternating current device which could time the signal to the stimulus to say 2 seconds or 3 seconds and then interrupt it. That works very well. That's very effective. And then there are other types of stimuli which, here's one we used very recently. You can make the current this way, you see. We built, had a stimulator built here, which, where the stimulus is a train of square waves like this, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can take the first one and deliver it here, the second one, deliver it to this channel, the third one, and so on, so that you get a repetition. This is at 500 per cycle, per second, but this is only 62.5 per second, you see. And that works very nicely.
When was that developed?
Well, this particular one was, other people have had different devices for doing it, but what I wanted to do in this experiment was to not just stimulate a single point with on the cortex this way, but to have 8 electrodes, each in a different position, but all within an area which they would move the fingers. And then no 2 stimuli hit the cortex at any given time, you see. Each one and each channel hits it at a separate time, but all stimulate in a period of about 62 seconds, and that's about a minute. Each site will get stimulated around 62 times, 62 and a half times.
Per second.
Per second. And the result of that turned out to be that the amount of current you had to use at any one of these was much less than if you tried to stimulate and get a response with just a single channel.
And this was a later...
This is something just recently done, yes. Mm-hmm. So that's something. But that kind of a current was available also then. But
by the way,
yes.
Was Chandler Brooks still there while you were doing this? You had worked with him at the beginning, hadn't you?
Well, he came with Bard from Harvard. And he and I were the two members of the department who were interested in the nervous system beside Dr. Bard.
Hmm. So there was the three of you for a while.
He worked with Bard on the problems of sex behavior, particularly working on rabbits. Bard's animal was the cat, and Brooks's animal was the rabbit. The rabbit is of interest from the point of view of ovulation in that there's an automatic ovulation with sexual intercourse that doesn't follow with many other animals. Mm. And it's sort of triggered by the intercourse that gives rise to the ovulation.
Now, you were, from early on then, interested in comparative studies, so you were looking at many different animals.
That's right.
And your goal, and what was your goal then in comparing different kinds of animals?
Well, I think the question was, of course, we knew that the areas were bigger in man and in chimps and in monkeys, and from the work that had been done by stimulating the brain, we knew the areas were bigger. We wondered whether they just were enlarged or whether they had been differentiated in some way to refine the representation for this part and that part. And that's, of course, what it turned out to be. For example, in a rabbit, the sensory and the motor areas are largely concerned with the face. Movements, tactile input from the face and movements of the facial muscles. And the leg area is very small. Whereas in a monkey, the leg area is about as big as, almost as big as the arm or face area. So that we were then interested, and it was actually the rat which first drew our attention to the basic organization of the sensory cortex, and led us also to look at the motor cortex in the rat. And it turned out that there was a very simple plan. It's almost as if you skinned the animal and made its skin out on the surface of the brain, expanded the head portion, and contracted the leg portion, and this is the way it was laid down, so that you could go all the way from the tip of the nose along the back of the sensory of the animal's back to the tip of his tail, and you would have a continuous line of points on the cortex. When you come to a monkey, that isn't so anymore. The hind leg has enlarged so much that it's broken the sequence part, and the tail and the hip are left in one place, and then the back of the animal occurs in another, and finally the face is sort of torn off and separated, because the amount of cortex devoted to the arm and to the leg in the monkey, as compared with the amount devoted to his trunk, is extremely large, and so you would find it quite impossible to spread this out, the skin out on the cortex, and have enough room, especially since the motor area is doing exactly the same thing, and they're together like this, like the fingers are together, so that you would have difficulty finding the amount of cortex to cover. So the pattern seems to have been broken apart due to that need for additional space. Now, in the case of an animal without a tail, like the chimpanzee or the or other tailless primates, the part of the cortex which represents the tail doesn't represent it, because it doesn't have a tail. And it turns out, as you explore the cortex, say, of a chimpanzee, that what happens is that the leg, instead of the leg motor area and the arm area being together like this, they move this way, and they run parallel to another over the rim of the hemisphere. Hmm. And it's only the arm which then has to be modified, its representation has to be modified, and you don't have a connection in that case between the trunk area and the back of the and the top of the head, for example, because they're in separate places. Whereas in a human, in a cat or in a dog, they'll still be close enough together that you can see the relationship. So this was, as you say, this was one of the reasons for wanting to study these things comparatively, to see how they whole pattern developed and how one species was related to another. Now,
were you, Bard and Brooks, somewhat surprised at times? Were your findings unexpected when you did these studies?
Well, Brooks wasn't very much involved with the he didn't ever get involved with the evoked potential studies. I think the only thing we ever did together, which is related, was to do the motor cortex of the rabbit. And I had done the sensory cortex of the rabbit already. And then we did the, I believe that came first, or perhaps it was second. At any rate, we had been interested in the rabbit brain, and we got together on that on Saturday afternoons. Saturdays, we'd worked Saturdays on the rabbit.
So were you doing all of your studies then in this period before you started working with Dr. Rose? Were you working entirely with the somatosensory studies, or were you looking at the other senses at all?
Well, I'll come to that in just a moment.
Okay.
Then. I think it was in 1938, that means that 6 years after, no, 5 years after I started working with Bard, and after Marshall had established an electronics system for research, he was offered an opportunity to develop a similar laboratory in our Department of Ophthalmology. They were interested in studying the visual system. And so he, after finishing his National Research Council fellowship, went to work in the Wilmer Institute, which is the ophthalmological department at Hopkins. And so we had the equipment which he had built, and he built some more over at the new place, but I had the feeling that it would be desirable to learn a little bit more about the electronics and about how you made equipment, and so I got a Rockefeller Fellowship and went to the University of Pennsylvania, where Detlef Bronck, B-R-O-N-K, was the head of the biophysics department. And he had a splendid electronics engineer which made their equipment and also gave a course to the new postdoctoral fellows who came. And so I went up there to take this course with him. But it turned out when I got there that I was the only new chap who had arrived that year, and he said it wasn't worth giving a course to one person.
Tutoring.
So he undertook to show me personally how to build some stimulating equipment, and I did build a stimulator, which I took back with me. But most of my time was spent working with other people in the lab on experimental physiology. And since my need was for apparatus to take back, he agreed to build it. And he had his shop build me, and we paid for it, of course. Build a complete setup, which I then took back to Baltimore and used to establish my lab. When I went back to Baltimore, instead of returning immediately to the Department of Physiology, I was offered a grant by the Infantile Paralysis Foundation, and they still are an operative organization, but they have a different name now, and I can't remember what that is. But this grant was offered to the medical school through the Department of Orthopedic Surgery. So that item in there in my CV about orthopedic surgery means that I spent 2 years as a fellow, postdoctoral fellow, in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery, where we carried on work on the neuromuscular system. And next, this is the most important part of that period. Next door to my lab was the lab of a chap by the name of Ed Walzel, W-A-L-Z-L. He had had poliomyelitis and had been severely handicapped, but he went into biology after he got his PhD, and had become interested in the auditory system. And one of the things I'd wanted to study in going up to Philadelphia, because they had some refined techniques for studying the optic system, was to study the auditory system. But I couldn't find anybody there who was interested in the auditory system. And when I came back and I set up my lab in the surgical building where this research on the in orthopedics was going to take place, I found that right next to me was Ed Walzel. And I found what he was doing was quite related to what I had wanted to do in Philadelphia. Namely, he was studying the effects of lesions of the cochlea upon the cochlear microphonics. Not too long before that, Weaver and Gray at Princeton had discovered what is called the microphonic effect of stimulating the cochlea with sound waves. And so what Ed was doing was opening up the middle ear of the cat, taking a fine dental drill and burrowing a little hole over the through the capsule, and then taking a blunt point, something like that, to pencil tip size, to just depress the basilar membrane on which the hair cells, which are involved with hearing, are sitting, and that crushed them. And then that was a limited damage to the basilar membrane. So he then could go back and carry out the microphonic studies using different frequencies to see which ones where the response was affected by this particular lesion, and make different lesions in different places. And this way, he was able to show that there was a, as expected from some observations that had already been made on human ears that had, where people had gone deaf, they were able to show a systematic relationship between the frequency and the distance from the basal end of the cochlea. When I saw this, I suggested to him that we might, might electrically stimulate through those holes, explore the cortex and see whether we got a local effect to these different sites. So we did that, but we never got a local effect. Mm-hmm. And that's what he expected, because he said he didn't think there was any cortical localization. Mm-hmm. But I said, well, don't you think that the reason why we're not getting a local effect there is that the cochlea is full of fluid and the current doesn't stay put at the site where we introduce it, but it's spreading throughout and stimulating the whole thing, maybe. He said, if we could just take that liquid out and just stimulate the nerve fibers, maybe we'd get something. He said, well, the easiest way to do that is to open the cochlea up, and the nerve fibers will still be there, but the endings will be gone, and we'll just put the electrodes on the nerve fibers. And when we did that, we got immediate sharp results right away. So that was the second system that we worked on, third, you might say. We worked on the somatic sensory and somatomotor, and now we worked on the auditory. And that paper still gets quoted, because it was the first experiment in which localization for different parts of the cochlea was demonstrated in the cortex of the brain. Subsequently, he and I did cortical recordings when he made lesions in the cochlea the way he had done for the recordings of the microphonics. And we again found that if you made a lesion in the low frequency area of the cochlea, that is to say the apex, then the you couldn't record responses in the low frequency area of the cortex. If you made the lesion in the high frequency end of the cochlea, you couldn't record them in the high frequency end of the cortex. And so it proved to be a very profitable experience. I stayed only 2 years there in that lab.
39 to 41?
Yes, 39 to 41 when I went back to physiology. Ed Walso and I continued to work together. We then did the monkey in the same way we'd done the cat, stimulating the cochlear nerve. This was to be his primary responsibility to work that up, but unfortunately he became ill and died, and it's only this right now that paper is finally coming out. We have it in a volume that we just edited for on the auditory system.
Okay, now I'll